Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenning. On today's program, naturalist, artist, and NPR commentator Julie Zickafoos stops by to talk about her upcoming appearance at Antioch. And you'll hear from a Boston University med student about her experience in the aftermath of the marathon bombing. Up first, in the runoff race for Dayton mayor, current City Commissioner Nan Whaley and A.J. Wagner will appear on the November ballot. Whaley came out ahead with more than 50% of the vote in the special election last week. Current Mayor Gary Lightsel will serve for another 8 months. He was beaten by A.J. Wagner by a slim margin for second place. Whaley received the endorsement of the Democratic Party, though she was not backed by several fellow Democrats on the city commission. She also outspent both Wagner and Lightsel in the campaign. The vote was decided by fewer than 10,000 of the city's 141,000 residents. In the race for Dayton City Commission, Democrats, incumbent Joey Williams and Jeff Mims will move forward and appear on the November ballot, along with David Greer and David Ezrati. Joseph Lutz, the fifth candidate in the race for city commissioner, was eliminated. New figures from the Defense Department show that sexual assault in the military is increasing and that the vast majority of cases are going unreported. As WYSO's Emily McCord reports, Republican Congressman Mike Turner of Ohio's 10th District is proposing legislation to encourage victims to come forward.
At the same time that the military is implementing prevention programs, a Pentagon survey found sexual assault cases have risen by a third in 1 year. Of the 26,000 people that were victims of sexual violence, only 3,400 actually reported it. Congressman Mike Turner is co-sponsoring bipartisan legislation called the Be Safe Act. It would prohibit military chain of command from setting aside cases of sexual assault. And it would require that if a service member were convicted of a crime, that they'd be thrown out of the military. Turner says victims often face retaliation for reporting sexual assaults and hopes that new laws will help assure them that a conviction will stand.
This is the most egregious of crimes, and people who serve our nation shouldn't be at risk from those that they serve with. The culture in the military clearly is wrong, and it needs to be changed so that our service members can be safe.
Turner says he wants the proposal to be included in a defense policy bill that will be considered this summer. This comes just days after an Air Force official and Ohio native was arrested and charged with sexual battery. He was the chief of the Air Force Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Branch. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
Recently, Wittenberg University's Board of Trustees announced a plan to cut the almost $5 million from the budget over the next 4 years. WYSO's Wayne Baker reports that the university's president, Dr. Lori Joyner, believes that the school is on the right track to overcoming a $7 million budget deficit and developing a plan to make the school stronger in the future.
Joyner says that Wittenberg is facing the same type of fiscal problems that most institutions of higher learning are dealing with, and the same types of significant challenges.
Essentially, the challenges that we face are a shrinking high school population, a struggling economy, and families who are becoming increasingly price sensitive.
The university has cut courses, staff, and faculty to deal with its fiscal problems. Joyner feels that a plan has been put in place to deal with these issues.
We're bringing together a group of talented faculty and staff members to start thinking about how we can change our curriculum, how we can have clearer pathways to graduation, figuring out how we can partner with other institutions locally and globally.
Joyner says that Wittenberg will always attempt to provide a wide offering of courses while also delivering a strong liberal arts education.
If you talk to CEOs of large companies, there's been study after study that shows the sorts of learning outcomes that are best developed through a broad-based education, including things like critical thinking and problem solving and effective communication skills. Those are exactly the kind of skills that one secures through a liberal arts education.
Wittenberg's budget cuts will leave the university with a deficit of slightly more than $2 million. The school will need to find more cuts or develop new revenue to balance its budget in the next 4 years. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
The city of Dayton was hit hard following the housing crisis that began a few years back. Debate still continues about what effect federal stimulus monies had across the country, but many city governments welcomed the influx of cash. Amy Regal with the Department of Planning and Community Development says those programs have done a lot to help keep Dayton neighborhoods above water in tough times, but those programs are coming to an end.
More than likely by the end of 2014, we will be completely out of any of the funds. We still have some funds available at this point in time, but not as much as we had, say, 2 years ago. So we're already starting to feel the slowdown.
Regal says the mortgage crisis for Dayton hasn't necessarily ended, and so there's still more to do. City Commissioner Matt Joseph agrees, but he's optimistic about the direction Dayton is headed.
So we're coping. We're doing what we can to find money to keep knocking down houses that are abandoned and won't be able to be used again. We feel like that our economy had recovered just in time. The last couple of years, revenue has gone up enough that we haven't had to lay people off. The state has really stepped up as far as giving us money to knock down abandoned houses. So we're on track to do quite a few this year, 300 or 400. So we're going to be okay.
Finding funds to keep neighborhood stabilization efforts going will be a challenge for city leaders if neighborhoods like Dayton are to continue to become more stable. Housing markets will need to even out. Reports indicate that Dayton is in a rebound with strong housing prices in the first quarter, but statewide mortgage foreclosures appear to be at a 6-year high. Matt Joseph says the city is taking other steps to revitalize neighborhoods in the area.
What we're trying to do is find a successful institution in an area and then link development to that institution. So whether that's University of Dayton and Miami Valley Hospital in the southern part of the city, or a different hospital or a different school or a big successful business or whatever that might be in a neighborhood, we try to build off that and make sure that people are connected in the neighborhood. They realize what resources are there. And when you have somebody that's the 800-pound gorilla in the neighborhood anyway, if we can engage them and make sure that they're connected to the neighborhood activists, make sure they know what the needs of local folks are, local businesses, then that's good for everybody.
Give me an idea of some successful examples of what you're talking about. Certainly University of Dayton, as you mentioned, and Miami Valley Hospital.
But there are others, too. We have a partnership with Children's Hospital, a partnership with Good Sam that's just transformed that area. That's one that you can drive by now and see the difference from even a year ago or, heck, even 6 months ago. You know, there's a new road. There are a bunch of old and abandoned houses that are now knocked down. Good Sam has a new addition. So there are all kinds of things happening there. To take the Brown Street example that we just used, a lot of the properties that people see being knocked down on both sides of Brown Street, old abandoned businesses or houses, are the Miami Valley Hospital or UD or one of the local owners is doing that of their own volition now because it makes sense to have a good looking corridor, a good looking entrance to your business, and they'll do that in cooperation with the neighborhood associations.
With Miami Valley Hospital and their expansion, there's been a little bit of pushback on that.
Yeah, oh, definitely. That's where it's good to make sure there is good communication between whatever institution there is and the city and residents. They talked it through, and as I remember, not everybody was happy, but I think people were sort of resigned to the fact that they made an effort to get along with the neighbors, and the neighbors understood what the needs of the hospital were. So yes, of course, whenever you have that sometimes toxic mix of city and business and residents all together in the conversation, it's important to have communication to try to figure out how to make sure people's real needs are met without infringing on somebody else's.
The city of Dayton has been looked at as almost a divided city, east and west, and I want to know how the city addresses that and what other efforts are being made to bring portions of the city together, whether it's east, west, north, and south as well.
It has been. Dayton has historically been, especially the last 30 or 40 years, been very divided. I'm happy to report that that's lessening quite a bit now. The division, the racial division that we saw east and west, even 10 years ago when I started as a commissioner, has lessened quite a bit. Part of that is due to people moving different places in the city and hopefully not seeing racism or not feeling pressure to live in a certain side of the city. And the second part is that we've had an influx of immigrants who are living everywhere. So those sorts of things tend to break down the old established order, and that's a great thing. I'm glad that diversity is happening, and hopefully it'll speed up. Our government structure really does promote a broad view instead of a very parochial view. We five, my fellow commissioners and the mayor, the five of us, we all represent the city at large. We don't have districts. We don't represent one half or a quarter of the city. So we're expected to be out and about to the whole city. So we see everything. We see everybody. We go to all neighborhoods. We shake everybody's hand. The whole city is all of our responsibility. So I think that is a very good thing. And I think that it was with some foresight 100 years ago that the city fathers created it that way, because it really makes us accountable to the whole city. So I think the long-term trends are good. Obviously, there's still problem, but I think that we're on the right track.
And do you feel the revitalization efforts are spread throughout the city?
They are. We never have enough money to do everything anybody wants, but, you know, we do some things east, we do some things west. We put a brand new rec center a couple years ago west. We revitalized Laura Center east. Downtown, right in the middle, we do what we can there. South, we revitalized Brown Street. We put a little money into the road, and the private industry took off there. If you set up the system right, people get jobs, they buy new houses, new construction, things get knocked down when they should be knocked down, buildings are filled with the right uses, seniors have homes, and all kinds of good things. It's a virtuous cycle that we're long overdue for, and I think we're finally entering.
City Commissioner Matt Joseph, thanks for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Radio Rounds is the nation's first medical talk show created by medical students at Wright State University's Boonshoft School of Medicine in Dayton. The program explores the qualities of humanism in medicine through different perspectives, physicians, authors, students, patients, and healthcare leaders. Today on WISO Weekend, we have an excerpt from their program, Boston Strong, Medical Students Care for Bombing Victims. Program host Lakshman Swamy traveled to Boston to interview third-year medical students who provided care for victims of the Boston Marathon bombing that took place on April 15th. In this segment, Swamy speaks with Boston University med student Kristen Schwartz about her experience that day and in the weeks following.
We went down to the ER to see what we could do to help, and what we saw was a large volume of patients that were arriving with very serious injuries. A lot of people bleeding and a lot of people in distress. I've spent a lot of time in the emergency department through different rotations and things, but I've never seen that many people with that many serious injuries. I also saw something that I was very impressed by was the number of attending physicians and attending surgeons who were all there. It seemed within minutes of the attack, we had some of the best surgeons in the hospital all there, ready to help. Assembling teams of attending surgeons and residents, students to assist. Of course, there was a lot of adrenaline in the atmosphere and people were working very quickly. You know, the hectic environment, there was a system formulating of surgeons triaging people, assessing the wounds and assessing what order to take people to the OR and just getting organized and trying to take care of people as efficiently and as well as possible.
What was it like not, you know, at that time, not knowing what else would come? You know, I remember there was a lot of speculation about more bombs possibly going off and all this. So what was that like?
It was very stressful and frightening for everybody in the city. There were so many false reports coming across the news and coming across all different information sources across social media. No one really knew how many attackers there were, where they had planted bombs, where they would intend to plant bombs, and no one knew what to expect. So the city was afraid, I think, in some ways of what could potentially happen next. And we were waiting with bated breath, but at the same time, acting quickly and doing as much as we could to help the people that we knew needed help as fast as we could.
So I understand that not only were you in the ER taking care of the patients as they were coming in, but you had actually just started on your vascular surgery service. So could you tell me a little bit about just, you know, the kind of OR volume that the center was seeing that day related to this and just what your experience was on the vascular side as well?
On Marathon Monday, when patients started coming to the ER emergently, teams of trauma surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeons took patients to the OR emergently. The hospital did 16 operations in total within a period of 8 hours, which is an extraordinary example of efficiency in the OR and just high volume life-saving procedures for these patients, and stabilized patients. Four patients were observed and then discharged because they were stable for discharge. 19 patients were admitted overnight. And on the Tuesday after the marathon, the patients that sustained limb injuries were taken to the OR and formal amputation procedures were done. And that is amputation procedures are an area of expertise for vascular surgeons and also orthopedic surgeons. So my vascular surgery team cared for many of the patients who did have limb amputations, took them to surgery, took care of them before surgery, and then also throughout their recovery in the hospital afterwards.
As you know, as a healthcare provider in this case, what was it like for you taking care of people who had gone through something like this?
I think it was an almost surreal experience for us all. I think we were all in a lot of shock that this had happened in our city and to, you know, people who were not expecting this to happen to them, to have experienced such a horrible attack. And for us as the medical team, you know, we were there to provide support for our patients and their families, to help them cope as best we could with some circumstances that were unimaginable and very, very difficult. Our patients were probably the strongest people I've ever met in my life. They had incredible attitudes. They were, you know, very resilient people, very determined to get better and walk again. And it was a privilege to meet these people and to play even a small part in their recovery and to try and help them, you know, just move forward after such a life-altering experience.
And you're a marathon runner yourself. I understand you didn't run the marathon this year, but you have in the past. Just as, you know, separate from being a medical student and all of that, what was it like being someone who has ran this marathon before and lived in the city to kind of see this happen?
It was really difficult, and it felt very personal, like it felt for a lot of Bostonians. We all know Boylston Street really well. We all know the neighborhood. We've all been there, and it felt, you know, just very, very personal and very saddening. For me, I have run the Boston Marathon 5 times, and it's very dear to me. I was registered to run this year and decided not to at the last minute, ironically, because I've been so busy with my surgery rotation and long hours and on call and everything. But I decided to sit this year out and just be fully committed to the surgery rotation in my 3rd year at school. So when the attacks happened, I was very saddened and also concerned. You know, I had friends and friends of friends that were planning on going out and running the marathon that day. And we all knew that our friends were out there. And at the same time, there was, you know, the issue that I was registered with an official bib number. So my name was on the marathon's website as a runner. And so I had text messages and phone calls coming in from friends and cousins and aunts and uncles that thought that I was supposed to be running and they weren't seeing my finish time. So that was just another aspect that was difficult. And that's something that was, you know, very surreal and strange about the day too. But I was saddened. The Boston Athletic Association is a tremendous organization that's done a lot for Boston. They do a ton for charities. They put on this fabulous event that has a worldwide draw every year. And it was just sad to see something, such a happy day, such a happy, pure event that's, you know, geared a lot towards families and a lot towards, you know, the positive aspects of life, be so cruelly attacked like that.
You know, having gone through something like this, obviously so tragic, but also, you know, so shocking, right during your surgery rotation in your 3rd year, do you think that it had any impact on your growth as a physician?
I think it absolutely has had a huge impact on my growth as a physician and, you know, as a person overall. As a professional, I learned a lot about the power that comes in working as a team. You know, I saw physicians coming together, communicating very, very well and very efficiently to take great care of our patients. I saw an unbelievable level of commitment from the physicians, from the nurses, from all of the support staff, from everyone from the custodial staff that was keeping the ER flowing on the day of the marathon, to the department directors providing a broad level leadership and representation for the hospital. And I just saw the whole hospital coming together in an extraordinary way that has taught me a lot of just about systems and about the value of being a part of an extraordinary organization like Boston Medical Center. And I've just learned a lot about the capacity that one hospital can have to do a large amount of good. And it's been an inspiration, to be honest, in, you know, just my level of commitment to the profession and to my commitment to trying in any way to help individuals when they're going through illness or injury or sadness or grief. Having been there with these patients after the marathon has taught me a lot about coping and resilience. And I think that in the future, I hope be able to be there for patients in difficult situations in the future and just continue to grow as a physician.
Radio Rounds, Lakshman Swami speaking with Boston University med student Christian Schwartz. You can hear the full program at radiorounds.org. This is WISO Weekend. Julie Zikafoust is a writer, artist, naturalist, and she is from Ohio. She also is an NPR commentator. Julie, welcome to the studios.
Thank you. It's so great to be here in the new studios. I'm looking at spring leaves outside. It's beautiful.
It is. We're very pleased with our studios, and we're very pleased that you've come to visit us. You are going to be speaking at the Glen Helen Auditorium. It's a creativity workshop?
It is. Actually, I'll be there Friday from 6 to 9 as well, or at the Vernet Ecological Center. And what I'll be doing is trying to shake loose some creativity in local residents here to inspire them to write down their own recollections of Glen Helen and, you know, what it means to them, and try and get people to maybe even record on Saturday with us.
So I want to go back just a little bit, and we'll talk more about the event, but I want to talk a little bit about your childhood and where this love of nature and the land and animals came from.
Oh, well, my dad was a farm boy. He was raised on a farm in Iowa, and from a very early age, he taught me how to plant and tend plants and gardens and also about birds. And I kind of sparked on birds when I was about 8 years old. I saw a blue-winged warbler bathing in a little pool behind my house in Richmond, Virginia. And at that point, I had been obsessed with horses and cats, and that all fled my head when I saw that bird. It was like an instant spark. So from then on, I became obsessed with birds, and I've never let them go.
And you're the author of The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds, and that book was released maybe about a year ago?
Yes, it was March, right around March 6th, 2012. Yeah, and it's been very well received. It's a heavily illustrated memoir, basically, lots of my watercolors and sketches in it.
Can you give us a few examples of what we'll find in the book?
Well, it's a very intimate memoir about the kinds of things that I've done with birds. There are 25 species treated in the book, and each chapter is devoted to a species. And my test for whether or not a bird got included in the book was whether I had some meaningful experiences with it, like having been its mother, or fixed it when it was broken, or studied its nesting cycle, something like that. So it's a very personal book. And there are some, you know, kind of startling things in it, like I never knew before I raised baby hummingbirds that their only sensory organ is their tongue. And so in order to find something out about anything that's presented to them, they lick it. Well, they will run their tongue right up your nose if you're not careful. So not many people can say that they've had a hummingbird lick their nose.
We could paint them red and maybe have a better shot at that.
Sometimes my nose is red without paint.
You're working on a new book as well.
I am. And it's a bit of a spinoff of The Bluebird Effect. It's boy, I actually haven't even talked about this, but it's going to be my working title is Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. And that's the thing that I love to do most, is follow the nesting development of baby birds. And I'm actively doing it on my farm right now, actually.
Some of the press materials for your upcoming appearance, beautiful watercolors of nature scenes, some birds as well. And are you a natural at painting?
No, I wasn't, if you ask my parents. My sister, Mickey, 2 years older than I, was naturally talented and gifted at drawing. She could caricature, she could cartoon. And my father used to praise her paintings and drawings, and he would watch me do this slow boil because I had no natural gift for it. But I worked so hard to try to better my sister. So I've been doing this since I was very, very young. My parents, to their credit, always kept a huge pile of computer printout paper on the kitchen table and all kinds of markers and crayons for us. And that's what we did for fun. I didn't know, you know, that there was other stuff that you did than read and draw. That's what we did.
Our listeners probably know you best for your NPR commentaries and also a series of commentaries that we have run on Why So Weekend. And beautiful stories, beautifully told and very well written. One that sticks out in my mind and one that I've certainly never forgotten is your attempt to prolong the life of a praying mantis.
Oh, never do that.
It was, I don't know, there's something about that story. Yeah. I understand what, can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, insects are designed to die in the fall. That's what they're made for. And I don't know if you've seen that movie, Death Becomes Her, with Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep. But basically, if you take a praying mantis in at the first frost and keep it in your house and feed it mealworms or crickets or whatever you can catch for it, it will do fine for a number of weeks. And then it will start slowly deliquescing and dropping a limb here and a limb there. It's very, very sad. And pretty soon you have this poor three-legged thing hobbling around and you realize that nature has a plan. And when you mess with it, you get to see the sort of ugly consequences. But I adore mantises, and they seem to have a sentience that many insects, I guess, don't convey to us. And you know, this thing, when I would walk by, it would reach out with her pinchers and ask to be given a ride to somewhere else in the house that maybe had a spot of sun. She was like a cat. It was an amazing insect.
A lot of your commentaries also deal with your family and home life.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Wow. I'm a mother of a 13-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl, and I've been prom dress shopping online lately. I had a little lesson in DNA the other day. We were frustrated because the nearest store to us is 2 hours away in Columbus. We're in the middle of nowhere. And my daughter and I had a fruitless shopping trip. So someone suggested we shop online at a large department store online. So there were about 4 pages of dresses, 50 dresses on a page. And I looked at them and I picked one dress that I knew would look fabulous on my daughter. She came in the room. I said, I'm not telling you. She went through the 500 dresses and picked the same dress. And I said, babe, that's DNA in action.
Tell us about your home. Now, you live, or you've made your home into a nature preserve?
Yes. Basically, when we came, we bought 40 acres with an oil well, so we had free gas to heat our house. And then we subsequently bought an additional 40 acres to make an 88-acre sanctuary. And it's probably, well, but for our neighbors, 85 acres, these are about the only properties that aren't hunted or cut in the immediate area. You know, most people are selective logging and they're, you know, allowing a lot of hunting, turkey and deer and everything on their land, trapping. And so it truly is a sanctuary. And it's very interesting to see it go from a sort of exhausted, cut over, overgrazed, you know, and it was a commercial orchard. Very interesting to see it mature and to see things change, the bird populations change. We've been there since 1992.
As you detailed in the Bluebird Effect, the connection with animals and helping injured animals and being allowed into their confidence for a couple of months, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that connection between man and nature.
Yeah, well, that's I guess what I can offer most is an ability to go into the intimate lives of animals and birds just by stopping to help them. It's uncanny. For instance, yesterday, a dove, a morning dove, arrived at my feeder, and I looked at her, and she looked familiar to me. I got my binoculars, and I saw her eyes were slightly misshapen, and she had a scar across the top of her head. Went back in my photos and my notes in my blog, Julie Zickovich on Blogspot, and I found photos taken on Halloween Day 2011 of a morning dove who had been scalped by a Cooper's hawk. I saw it happen. She flew into my studio window. The hawk veered off, but not before he ripped her scalp open with a talon. So here was this poor thing lying dazed on the ground with her skull completely exposed. Well, I thought about it, and I didn't think I could suture the skin because dove skin is thinner than wet Kleenex. I used superglue. And as soon as I ascertained that it was holding and it was healing fine, I let her go. Well, her eyes looked strange. It's like she'd had a facelift, sort of a Joan Rivers thing where her eyes were a little too – like her face was too tight. Here comes this thing, you know, 2 years later, comes into the feeder like she'd been doing it all her life. And I said, I know you. So, of course, I photographed her. This is the kind of thing that I do. I get involved. I remember these birds. Maybe they remember me. She sure looked at me.
And the feeling that you had when you saw her again and
realized. Oh, my gosh. It was fabulous. It was just – you know, it's – I call that blog gold, you know? If you've been doing a blog for 8 years and you have a nice story you can tell, a little kernel that'll come around and give everybody a satisfying ending. That's pretty awesome.
That's great. I know we're on a time limit, but I do want to remind listeners that on Saturday, May 18th, you'll be at Glen Helen Auditorium. Also, a creativity workshop taking place on Friday, May 17th, and you can get advanced registration details at glenhelen.org.
Looks like we'll be going all day Saturday, too.
Okay.
So I think they're gonna get their money out of me.
Great. And for people who, again, remind us of the Blogspot and your website.
Yes, Julie Zickefus on Blogspot, and that name is spelled Z as in zebra, I-C-K-E-F as in Frank. O-O-S as in Sam E.
Julie Zickefus, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, it was great. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.